All right, welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals. We have two cases on our oral argument docket today, and I understand all the lawyers have checked in and designated who will be arguing as well as their time. We may take a break. We'll just see when we get there, okay? The first case is City of Bedford versus Apartment Association of Tarrant County, Inc., cause number 216356 CV, and I believe we're beginning with Mr. Boyle.
May it please the court. Matthew Boyle here on behalf of the City of Bedford. The trial court erred in this case when it denied the City of Bedford's plea to the jurisdiction. The basis of that error is that the plaintiff absolutely failed to establish the trial court's jurisdiction over any of their causes of action. As a home rule municipality, the City of Bedford is generally entitled to the protections of immunity, and that immunity applies to immunity from suit and immunity from liability.
Could you speak up just a bit? I'm having trouble hearing you.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
The city's entitlement to immunity can only be waived by an express act of the legislature, and that waiver must be clear and unambiguous. But even with the existence of such a waiver, the plaintiff bears burdens, and in this case there are three particular burdens the plaintiff bore that they failed to meet. Number one is they have to plead the existence of that clear and unambiguous waiver. Number two, they must show the factual applicability of the waiver. And number three, and this is from our perspective their most problematic point, is that when the city's plea was supported by evidence, as it was in this case, the plaintiff bears the burden to submit evidence to raise a question of the court, to raise a genuine question of material fact.
Counsel, the evidence that you're referring to, was that something other than what was attached to your motion for summary judgment, which was not before the court when it had the plea of the jurisdiction hearing?
The evidence was attached to that particular pleading, but what I would direct the court's attention to, Justice Kerr, is that that pleading was actually entitled the City of Bedford's Motion for Summary Judgment and Brief in Support of its Plea to the Jurisdiction. And the first, I think it's 11 pages of that particular pleading are dedicated solely and not mixed in any way to the issues of immunity and the plea to the jurisdiction. So that is the pleading and the evidence, Your Honor.
Well, as I recall, Judge Wilkinson said on the record at the beginning of your hearing that she hadn't even looked at the summary judgment materials. So obviously you didn't request that that hearing be rescheduled or anything to give her a chance to look at that, but do you think that she would have come to a different conclusion if she had reviewed your evidence?
I would hope that we would have, but during the hearing, because it was before the court, we based our argument around that evidence because it was properly before the court. That evidence was submitted with our brief that was filed on August 5th of 2016. This hearing wasn't held until, I think, September 26th, 2016. So when you look at the standard that says when evidence is submitted, it should be treated tantamount to a motion for summary judgment. Even in that scenario, when the 21-day rule didn't apply, we beat it and then some. And so I would hope that had she had taken the opportunity to read that pleading and the evidence associated with it, that she would have ruled differently. And I'm hopeful that this panel will do likewise. Because when you look at it, we submitted evidence that clearly and unequivocally establishes the city's continued entitlement to immunity. But there's not any corresponding evidence from the plaintiff that would even give rise to a potential question.
Well, you say you had the evidence that shows your entitlement to immunity. If I understand the appellee's position, it is that the Declaratory Judgment Act, which obviously gives people a chance to challenge the validity of an ordinance, are you saying that what you put before the trial court was the same thing basically as showing on the merits they couldn't win, as opposed to showing that they weren't entitled to proceed under the Civil Practice and Remedies Code?
Thank you, Your Honor. You're allowing me to skip a little bit ahead in my outline because I did anticipate the question of merits versus jurisdiction being raised. And here what I would point the panel to is a case for one of my other city clients, the City of Argyle. And in that case, it was an appeal on the denial of a plea to the jurisdiction of the trial court. And that is City of Argyle versus Pierce. The site on that is 258 Southwestern 3rd, 674. And a little bit of irony on that is the panel at that particular time consisted of then Chief Justice Casey, current Chief Justice Livingston, and Justice McCoy, who wrote the opinion where that exact issue was raised. And I want to read the quote from that particular case where this issue was raised. They said, "Here we have examined the allegations in plaintiff's petition as well as the evidence presented to the trial court, but we reached the opposite conclusion. The plaintiffs have not stated a valid claim for a constitutional taking. Because the plaintiffs have not stated a valid inverse condemnation claim, governmental immunity applies, and the trial court should have granted the city's plea to the jurisdiction."
Was that a declaratory judgment case?
I believe that it was. That analysis is what I'm asking this panel to undertake today, which is an analysis of both the pleadings and the evidence. And here, when you have unrefuted, unobjected to evidence that supports the city's defense, and you have no evidence to the contrary to raise a question of material fact, the question that's before the court is, have they stated a valid claim? And our contention is, it is woefully insufficient to baldly state or baldly allege that we have somehow violated a constitutional provision when there is no factual evidentiary support, especially and most importantly after the city has submitted its evidence that establishes to the contrary.
Well,
yes.
I keep harping on the fact that your evidence was attached to something called a motion for summary judgment, which was not set for hearing. I mean, if you were in the plaintiff's position, would you be expecting that you should have filed some sort of controverting evidence to a summary judgment motion that wasn't set?
The title, as I said before, was Motion for Summary Judgment and Brief in Support.
Yeah, I know what the title was, but when I see brief in support, I'm expecting legal argument, which is what you had in there, but when I see motion for summary judgment, I'm expecting evidence, which you had.
But if you
beating a dead horse.
You are not beating a dead horse, and I appreciate the questions. When you go back, if you take the opportunity to review that particular pleading, you will find that the only time that evidence is noted is in the first 11 pages, which are dedicated exclusively to the issue of immunity and not related to our arguments under 166 under the motion for summary judgment. They're all in the first 11 pages. Given the fact that it was filed more than a month and a half before the hearing, I think there was more than ample opportunity for everybody to be apprised of what the city's legal and evidentiary perspectives were. Based on the city's unrefuted evidence, the plaintiff, as I said, has failed to meet its burden to establish the trial court's jurisdiction. There are pleading deficiencies, but save and except for their challenges to Ordinance 2334, it's perhaps possible that if they were given the opportunity to amend their pleadings, they could solve those. But the pleading defects with Ordinance 2334 are fatal and incurable. So we stand before you today asking this panel to reverse the trial court's denial of the city's plea to the jurisdiction and render judgment in favor of the city. As I believe is abundantly clear to the panel, this case involves a challenge to the City of Bedford's minimum housing code regarding multifamily complexes and the fees assessed by the ordinances for both inspection and registration, and those are found in the currently valid ordinances 16-3151 and 16-3152. Although plaintiff also attempts to challenge Ordinance Number 2334, that ordinance was admittedly, by both sides, repealed by Ordinance 16-3151 and as such is not in effect at all. Plaintiff's requests for declaratory relief are based on two different provisions of the Texas Constitution, Article 1, Section 19, and Article 8, Section 1F, but there's no evidentiary support for those claims whatsoever. I will briefly review what the standards are for those two constitutional provisions under the Declaratory Judgment Act. Under Article 1, Section 19, it's the due process provision. And the question there is, was there a rational basis for the challenged ordinances and/or are the ordinances arbitrary and capricious? Under Article 8, Section 1F, the question is, this is the occupation tax provision. Question there is whether the primary purpose of the ordinance was raising funds as opposed to regulation, and whether or not the fee imposed raised more funds than reasonably necessary to cover the cost of the program. Baldy claimed that an ordinance's unconstitution is not sufficient to establish the trial court's jurisdiction. Bedford's unrefuted evidence establishes that the ordinances were enacted to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public, and that the amount of revenue raised by such fees was calculated precisely to cover only the cost of administering the registration and inspection programs. City evidence and ordinances 16-3151 and 3152 are also supported by the affidavit of Megan Jakubik, which you can find in the clerk's record at pages 163-3166. No objection of any kind was raised prior to the hearing, not during the hearing when that evidence was argued, and you can see it in the transcript of the hearing that we talked about the evidence repeatedly during the hearing. No evidence at any time, no evidentiary objection at any time has been made to the city's evidence.
Counsel, is it your position that, I mean, because your plea to the jurisdiction itself was, seems to be limited to 2334, and some of these arguments that are being made, I guess, in your brief in support of your plea to the jurisdiction, do you believe that your briefing on that could enlarge what you actually were complaining about in your plea to the jurisdiction?
I believe that our plea to the jurisdiction is broad and general, and it broadly and generally challenges whether or not the plaintiff has established the trial court's jurisdiction as to all of the causes of action. That's my contention, Your Honor. The evidentiary, when you look at the appellant's brief, the appellee's briefing, the only time they talk about our evidentiary issues is in footnote number 2, where they note, as the panel did previously, the trial court admitted for some reason that she did not read it. We can't make the trial court read pleadings that we put before them, but we did timely submit it well beyond what the standard would be had it been a traditional motion for summary judgment, and we argued it at the time. Her failure or refusal to read a pleading does not affect its existence in the court's record.
Counsel, was the, I think it was the city manager's affidavit that was submitted, was that the only evidence on these ordinances and their relationship to taxation, or?
There were three pieces of evidence. One was the affidavit of Megan Jakubik, and the other pieces of evidence were the ordinances themselves.
Okay.
And the key thing about the ordinances themselves relative to what those constitutional standards are is, for instance, whether or not they are arbitrary and capricious. I will just direct the panel to some of the legislative findings in the ordinances. At the clerk's record on page 71 in section 22-347 of ordinance 16-3151, it states, the purpose of this chapter is to protect the public health, safety, and welfare of the citizens by establishing minimum standards. It goes on in the legislative binding sections to say that in the city, structures used for human habitation, which are or may become in the future substandard, could constitute a menace to the health, safety, and welfare and reasonable comfort and or quality of life of its citizens. So under the two constitutional provisions that they've cited, one is based on the allegation that the city was somehow unreasonable, arbitrary, or capricious in the adoption of its ordinance. But there, the standard is high on the plaintiff because there's a presumption of validity when an action is ordained by the city council. The real question is that you can only overturn it if the governmental body could have had no legitimate reason for its decision. That's Kaplan versus Clear Lake Water City Water Authority at 794F2nd 1059. The primary purpose question is the other question, which I believe you're talking about, is on the taxation, and there's the two-part test of what's the primary purpose. And here, when you read those legislative findings that explain from the city council why they adopted the ordinance, and what the cases say you're supposed to do is look at the ordinance as a whole to make that determination on primary purpose. If you make a determination at the outset that the primary purpose is to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public, I'm not certain you even get to the second test on whether or not the ordinances themselves raise more money than the program's cost to administer. But here, Ms. Jakubik's affidavit clearly establishes that those fees were methodically calculated only to raise a sufficient amount of money to cover the cost of administering the program. Based on that, Your Honors, we assert that the plaintiffs failed to establish the trial court's jurisdiction. And the last thing I want to point out factually, though, is a note on Appley's statement regarding oral argument, where they say at the outset in there, and this is the quote, "The relevant facts are undisputed." So they can't, on one hand, take the position that the relevant facts are undisputed, and then, on the other hand, come back and assert, right, I would respectfully request that they not be allowed to come back and assert that there are factual issues. And given the factual evidence that's before the court, we contend that they did not meet their burden to establish the trial court's jurisdiction, and accordingly ask that you reverse the trial court and grant the city's plea to jurisdiction. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Boyle. Mr. Casey.
Thank you, Chief Justice Livingston. May it please the court. Good afternoon. Throughout its briefs, the city has spent the majority of its argument this afternoon urging the court to improperly skip the jurisdictional issues and go straight to the merits of the association's claims. Judge Wilkinson refused to fall into that trap, and I trust this court will refuse to be drawn into that trap as well.
But isn't it true that we're allowed, I mean, a plea to the jurisdiction under these circumstances is kind of a weird duck, I guess, in a way, isn't it? Because if there are factual considerations, aren't they to be considered?
Your Honor, no, they're not. And that's the difference between a declaratory judgment action in which the validity of a municipal ordinance is at issue and a case like the City of Argyle, where the jurisdictional issues are intertwined with the merits. And that's where the Miranda case has particular applicability, because Miranda, as you know, was a tort claims, Texas Tort Claims Act case. It wasn't a declaratory judgment action case. And the Texas Tort Claims, immunity or waiver of immunity is intimately intertwined or connected with the merits of the case. And so, yes, you do get into facts, and fact issues do determine at sometimes when evidence is presented in a case like that whether there's jurisdiction over the claim and whether the immunity has been waived. Under the Declaratory Judgment Act, subject matter jurisdiction does not turn on whether there's a factual dispute about the merits of the plaintiff's claims when the validity of a municipal ordinance is at issue. Governmental immunity, as the court, the Dallas Court of Appeals recognized and other courts that we've cited recognize, governmental immunity is waived if the proceeding involves the validity of the ordinance, nothing more, nothing less. All that a plaintiff is required to do in a case such as that is allege facts which, if taken as true, would support the invalidity of the ordinance in question. And that's what the association has done here. In its first amended original petition, the city alleged that it was advised, the association alleged that it was advised that the actual cost for regulating license and ordinances was $10.18 per unit per year. Under the three ordinances in question, the license and inspection fees, the city, the association has alleged, has ranged from anywhere from $18 per unit per year to over $53 per unit per year. The association has alleged that the excess revenue has been used to defray the cost of the city's fire and police departments, that the fees and unusual number of inspections under the ordinances are unreasonable with no rational basis, so, excessive.
So is it your position that we should just ignore the city manager's affidavit altogether?
At this stage, yes, Your Honor. That does not go to the jurisdiction. In fact, according to every relevant authority cited by both parties in this case, the city's allegations in this case are all that it needs to invoke the immunity waiver and the jurisdiction of the trial court. It was not required to produce evidence controverting the city's self-serving legislative findings that this was an exercise of police power or the city manager's affidavit. In fact, even if this were a merits inquiry, which it's not, and even assuming the fees were intended for the purpose that the city says that they were intended for, under the Texas Supreme Court's decision in Loewenberg versus City of Dallas, it's a 2008 decision, the question of whether the fees are a prohibited tax would not turn on what the city says the fees are being used for. It would instead turn on whether they raise, the fees raise, more revenue than is reasonably needed to regulate licenses and inspections. In Loewenberg, the owners of commercial buildings filed a class action against the City of Dallas challenging an ordinance that imposed a fire registration fee on owners of commercial buildings that the city stated in its legislative findings was intended to offset administrative costs related to the city's commercial building fire prevention program. The Supreme Court in that case held that even if the stated purpose of the fee was fire protection of commercial buildings, which is a laudable purpose, the evidence in that case showed the revenue generated greatly exceeded the cost and was therefore a prohibited tax. So in other words, whatever label the city puts on its fees and on the ordinances, whatever legislative findings it makes in a case like this, those are not controlling. The critical issue, as the Supreme Court said in another decision that's applicable here, the Llewellyn case, the critical issue is whether the assessment actually raises more revenue than is reasonably needed for the regulation at issue. And that, Your Honors, is a fact question for the fact finder to decide on the merits. It's not a jurisdictional issue at all. The Loewenberg case is also on all fours with regard to the mootness argument that the city has made here. In Loewenberg, the City of Dallas made the same argument that Bedford is making with regard to the repealed ordinance that we've challenged here, and that is that the plaintiff's claim was mooted by the repeal of the ordinance. And here's what the Supreme Court said in the Loewenberg decision, flatly rejecting that argument. I quote, "The city cannot extract millions in unlawful fees and fines, decide the whole thing was a mistake, keep the money, and then insist the whole matter is moot. For those who paid, the controversy remains real." And we would say that that is likewise true here for every member of the association that paid what we allege is an unlawful
Do you happen to know, I'm just curious, if I'm remembering the Loewenberg case correctly, did the City of Dallas, I don't recall that that involved a plea to the jurisdiction. Is that the one that first went to federal court and it got dismissed and then the plaintiff filed a class action?
Yes, Your Honor.
But was
and
there a plea to the jurisdiction?
It was a summary judgment case.
Right.
It arose from a summary judgment.
But did the city attack it on a plea to the jurisdiction? Do you know?
I believe the city did.
Oh, okay. I just don't recall seeing that part of the opinion. Okay.
And, in fact, that's one of the reasons why there was the argument on the in the appeal that, you know, the same argument the city's making here, well, the purpose is thus and so, and therefore, you know, there's no jurisdiction. But it did arise out of the summary judgment proceeding,
merits,
Your Honor.
Yeah.
It's correct about that.
My
point is simply that even if we had a merits inquiry here, and even if you take what the city says is true, that it's a fact issue for the jury to decide or for the trial court to decide as to whether there's an impermissible tax. Yes, Your Honor.
I wanted to follow up on the refund issue and whether you're suing on behalf of these clients for a refund. In other words, are you just asking the court to make this decision and a declaration regarding the status that the ordinance would have had had it remained in effect, thereby creating the foundation for a subsequent suit maybe to seek a refund.
I think that's a fair statement. We're not seeking money damages here. The association is simply asking for declaration that's permissible under the Loewenberg decision and under this court's decision in McDaniel versus Town of Double Oak. I believe Justice Walker authored that decision that would simply declare that members who paid the illegal tax are entitled to relief on the basis of that, and it's Texas law is clear that when you pay an illegal tax and your payment is not voluntary, that there is, you do have a right to relief on that. And of course, that is a claim for prospective relief. It's, we're not asking for a refund of damages in this particular suit. That answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes, thank you.
Isn't that the very point that makes it not moot? Is that you paid the money and you're out the money? Isn't that what the Supreme Court said? That's what made it not moot?
Exactly.
But you're not seeking that the money be returned.
Well, we're seeking a declaration that
as
the ordinance
to a statute that's been repealed.
Well, we're seeking a declaration that, like in Loewenberg, it was a repealed ordinance, and that the parties who can show that they are in, have a right to relief, have paid and paid involuntarily, that they have a right to payment on that. But we're not.
Are you in the same procedural posture that Loewenberg was in? Are you seeking the very same thing, or did they seek monetary damages in there?
Well, actually, in Loewenberg, it was a summary judgment proceeding on the merits, and I recall that the damages there was proof of damages in excess of a couple of millions of dollars and so forth. So, but again, we rely on Loewenberg for the proposition that a repealed ordinance does not moot a claim like we have here.
Well,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I mean, and could the association, as I understand it, the association itself, having never paid any of these fees under the repealed ordinance, you wouldn't be able to recover money damages for the association. You're just setting up a circumstance where an individual apartment owner could decide to claim a refund. Is that right?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor. That's correct. There's another case directly on point on this that might help answer any other questions the court might have on the mootness, and that's the Matthews versus, I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this correctly, Counts School District. It's cited in our brief. It's a 2016 decision of the Supreme Court, which the Supreme Court held that the mere cessation of conduct or repeal of a statute does not in itself deprive a court of power to hear a claim for prospective relief. That instead, the court said that the party invoking the mootness doctrine has, quote, a heavy burden to show that the challenged conduct will not reoccur. And of course, the city hasn't made any effort whatsoever in this case to meet that burden. In fact, it's our position that the mere fact that the city continues to enact ordinances which we allege impose illegal fees or taxes on apartment owners disguised in the form of a fee proves that the challenged conduct will reoccur and has reoccurred until a court.
So you're arguing that it's capable of repetition yet evading review? Is that the argument you're making, or are you saying it's simply moot? Because the evading a review is an exception to mootness.
Exactly.
And is that your theory, or is it more, are you following Loewenberg that just says it's moot and doesn't really go into that?
Well, we're contending it's not moot.
Right.
And Matthews, Your Honor, I mean, that's a good question, because Matthews really kind of rephrased that whole exception that you're referring to. and said, you know, it's not just whether it's capable of repetition and evading review, but the burden is on the party invoking the doctrine to prove that it will not be repeated. And you know, I'm kind of old school on this. That's new to me. And so Matthews kind of taught me something in studying this case that I wasn't aware of. But that's the standard now. And, of course, the Lauenberg Court, I think, without saying as much, applied that same rule when it held that the repeal of the ordinance doesn't just let you walk away and say it's a mistake and keep the money and run. So, yes, we're saying both, Your Honor. But I'm just relying on the court's pronouncement in the Matthews case. And finally, I see my time's about to run. The city's argument about injunctive relief does not apply to a governmental entity flies right in the face of another Supreme Court decision, and that's the city of ELSA versus MAL. In that case, the court expressly held that injunctive relief and other equitable relief is available against a governmental entity to enjoin a violation of the Texas Constitution. Thank you, Your Honors. If you have other questions, we pray that the trial court's judgment be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Casey. Mr. Boyle, rebuttal.
May it please the court. I would like to direct the panel's attention to page 7 of the association's brief, where they say, to the extent a plea of the jurisdiction contests the existence of jurisdictional facts, which ours did, the court may consider relevant evidence submitted by the parties when necessary to resolve the jurisdictional issues raised. They go on, in reviewing the evidence, courts do not look to the merits of the plaintiff's case, but only consider the pleadings and the evidence pertinent to the jurisdictional issues and the inquiry before the court. And that's exactly what we're asking the panel to do today, not make a merits-based decision, but to make a jurisdictional decision, because that's what a plea to the jurisdiction is all about, a plea to the jurisdiction, questioning whether or not and asserting that the trial court did not have jurisdiction over the case because plaintiff failed to meet its burden.
And is it true that the court is the one that determines what evidence we would need to look at or the trial court needed to look at?
I think it falls under judicial discretion at both levels as to which evidence you wish to consider. The trial court's failure or refusal to look at evidence doesn't mean it's not in the record, and it doesn't mean it's not ripe before the court for your possible consideration. The next case I want to touch on, Your Honor, is the Lauenberg case versus City of Dallas, because it's instructive. Justice Kerr pointed out that case started in the federal court, went back down to the state court, where it went both to the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court on two different procedural perspectives. But the thing that's most important there is that in that case, the City of Dallas admitted that the fee was to benefit the general public by improving fire protection for everyone. And the Supreme Court further noted that the revenue generated greatly exceeded any regulatory cost. And so here we're down to the two standards of the two constitutional provisions asserted by the plaintiff.
So I guess a cynic would say, though, that based on Lauenberg, a smart city after that would be careful what it put into its legislative history or what it admitted.
We produced 6,000 pages of discovery documents in the face of a motion for protective order based on Miranda, and they didn't produce one shred of evidence. They didn't tell you today that they've got evidence to the contrary, because it doesn't exist. Those calculations were soundly and methodically developed specifically to change the perspective that the city had under Ordinance 2334, which was the general fund was subsidizing the protection and the health and safety of multifamily apartment complexes. And the thing about it, when you talk about the primary purpose, so one is rational basis, and there's absolutely no evidence or no argument that the city lacked a rational basis given what the standard is relative to those legislative determinations. So on the second issue, constitutionally, the primary purpose question. The thing about Muhlenberg is I actually went down to track down City of Dallas Ordinance 22206 to read it, and it's completely and strikingly different than Ordinance 16-3151 because all it is a fee ordinance. It doesn't include any regulatory provisions whatsoever, whereas the City of Bedford's ordinances are replete with important critical safety measures intended to ensure that the residents of their apartment complexes have a safe, sound, and habitable place to call home. And the Ukubic affidavit unquestionably establishes that those calculations do not result in the city collecting more revenue than is necessary to administer the program. I respectfully ask this court to review the ordinance, make that determination primary purpose, because that's the threshold question on that one. If you determine that the primary purpose of that ordinance is for regulation, they have absolutely unequivocally not met their burden to establish the trial court's jurisdiction. Based on that and clear and repeated regulatory functions that are included in the ordinance, we assert that they have not established the trial court's jurisdiction, and as such, the city's plea of the jurisdiction should have been granted. We thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for both the appellant and the appellee, we appreciate your arguments and all of your briefing today. Your case is now submitted, and you all are excused.
I'm good.